Hi, Ann.
Hi, Jim.
So this is our No Stupid Things episode.
We will not say anything stupid refuses to edit or make any cuts.
Oh, I make cuts all the time. Okay. Like that time when I gave the secrets inadvertently for making an atomic bomb. Remember that?
On our podcast.
And then I edited all of that
out. Today, we're going to be talking a little bit different. I think something a little bit different. We're going to be talking about a memoir by Anthony Doerr called Four Seasons in Rome. This was published in 2007, so 15 years ago. Hmm. And in this memoir, Doerr really recounts, it really is largely sort of like a diary, but recounts a year that he spent with his family, his wife and his newborn twins in Rome. It was a year, actually, he came home from the hospital where his twins were born and found the notification from the American Academy of Rome that he had won the Rome Prize. And it was, I believe it, he hadn't even applied for it.
He knew nothing about the Rome Prize.
He knew nothing about it. He had never been to Italy. And what's interesting about this book that I thought maybe we could talk about is the bottom line is he describes living in a foreign country as being like being a new parent. Hmm. Or maybe being a new parent is like living in a foreign country. I think that. So it's sort of both those things are going on at the same time.
Well, he's got twins.
And
right?
He's got twins. I know.
Right. So that's a special.
So we have four kids. One at a time. We had them one at a
twins
time.
Separated by a few years.
Yeah. So whenever I see people with twins, I'm just, you know, yeah. I'm in such awe. But so they're, and also these are their first children, and they are about 6 months old, I think, when they go to Italy. So it also is an account of those very early years, really very early year. They go from, you know, 6 months old, they're just sitting up, and I think they're still breastfeeding, and to where they're crawling and they're walking and they're starting to say their first words. And on the other side, about living in a foreign country, it's about all the new things, trying to learn Italian, trying to figure out where you get your groceries, where you buy the diapers. Mm-hmm. You know, they had kind of a couple of like crash course Italy, or crash course Italian. So to know a little bit, but he talks about, you know, going to get the sauce and instead of asking for
pomodoro, he asks for pompelmo.
Right. The grapefruit sauce instead of tomato sauce. And
anyone could make that mistake.
And Doerr, at the same time, he's working on a novel which ends up becoming All the Light We Cannot See, which is a novel that takes place during World War II. It doesn't take place in Italy or anything, but the idea of the Rome Prize is it gives him the time and the space to work on this novel. So he also describes, I think it's beautifully, the frustrations and struggles of a writer who now he's got all this time and space, and he has days where he just can't write. He just can't think of anything mm-hmm. to write. He does end up writing this book, All the Light We Cannot See, which is an excellent book. I highly recommend it. I thought it was really good.
But it seems like he goes, so it's four seasons.
Yes.
And it seems like he goes through one season without writing anything. That's what it seems like.
He's kind of like,
today I wrote like a sentence in my journal, but I really didn't write anything. And then it seems to come. The thing that that seems to happen is there's a kind of shock of Rome itself. He's sort of overwhelmed by Rome and the experience. And I think he's reflecting on that and journaling about it. But it's not what he's there for.
About to experience Rome.
Yes.
Right.
Right. He's there to write this novel that's set in Normandy, right?
Well, and yes. And then the other thing to keep in mind is they're from Boise.
Right.
Right. So this is really a culture shock.
Yeah, there's a very nice fish out. So what I love about the book is the kind of, you mention all of these themes. And they weave sort of seamlessly one from the other. It's not sort of like there'll be this long disquisition on sort of being a fish out of water, then a long disquisition on being a parent. There's none of that. What I'm saying, he in the course of remembering it with a very strong narrative sense and a very conversational way, he weaves this kind of without you noticing, and suddenly you realize you've been reading the last day and you realize, well, we've talked about what it's like to be terrified that your children are dying, what it's like not to have any idea how to do basic things like order coffee or why the coffee things are the way they are. He talks about the sense there's one point where he goes to England and he feels like he's letting down the team because England's going to be too easy because I'm going to know everything. Like here it's the struggle. And there is that weird thing. Once you're in a place where you don't speak the language that somehow you're cheating when you go to the English speaking place.
Right. It's easy. Plus he's on his own. He doesn't have the kids along. And so I remember describing having young children as being like, you do all the things that you have to do. You know, I still like with older children and before I had children, I still had to cook and do laundry or whatever, but it's as though you're doing all those things with weights attached to you. So everything mm-hmm. is harder and it takes longer and it's more exhausting, you know, or, it's like running, but in a pool, you know, and so it's like, hey, I can run, but.
Is it just me or does he seem to be the neurotic parent in this?
He does. I wondered if he's very sympathetic. I mean, he's very kind to his wife, but, yes. or she is the long suffering. I can't remember. Shauna.
Yes. But he's the one who seems to have all these irrational worries that are popping. And some of them are, you know, he has a couple of, you know, being in Rome, you always think about the drivers and, you know, the horrible accident. Yeah, right off,
there was a car accident outside, you know, right nearby. And that worry that you can't always be there for your children, that you can't watch them each and every second of the day. And obviously with a small child of this age, you are, you know, someone's with them 24/7. But that reality that, you know, things are unpredictable. I was thinking he also is just, you know, you talked about how he kind of seamlessly, it has a little bit about Rome, a little bit about parenthood, a little bit about writing. Mm-hmm. And I just opened it up to this part about the kids teething. Mm. Maybe I'll just read. I mean, yes. It's only a couple of paragraphs. I came through the door carrying two sacks of tulip bulbs. I should say, of course, we're now in spring. Hmm. Shauna tells me the boys have started skipping naps again. And they scream for no reason, she says. They're sitting there drooling away, and suddenly they start screaming. Constipated? Hungry? We pry open their mouths and peer in. The tissues of their gums are swollen and red. They have runny noses. They want to be held nonstop. All week, we take turns aiming brown, bad-smelling drops onto their gums, wrestling them into diapers, handing them frozen washcloths to suck on. In the mornings, I mold paragraphs for my short story, examine them, try to figure out what I want to say. As soon as I'm back in the apartment, I hurry Shauna out. Watching teething babies is like watching over a thermonuclear reactor. It is best done in shifts by well-rested people. So that I like that, what you were just saying. There's a little bit about parenting. There's a little bit about writing. There's a little bit about Rome. You even have this little, you know, the tulip bulbs that we're coming into another season. And so I think that idea of the four seasons of Rome, of course, it describes this one year, but it's also about life mm-hmm. and about how life has seasons, you know, and the seasons of the year are, it's interesting because it's linear, but at the same time, it's also cyclical. Mm-hmm. So we have life as a line. I mean, it's one thing happens, especially think about a baby growing up, but it's also the seasons keep coming, you know, mm-hmm. and they will keep coming.
Yeah. And he's open to all of that. I mean, that's the thing that strikes me, and well, and one of the things that strikes me in his writing is he's got a kind of writerly vulnerability. So in our podcast, we'll talk, we want to get things right. And as a writer, you kind of want to have this air of presenting something that is polished, but he's one thing, and the writing is polished, but what I really admire is he really talks about just sort of the things that might be embarrassing. So he talks about things like, you know, I came in and people were telling me, oh, you have to be here. You haven't been to this, to Trajan's. And I was like, I had no idea what this thing was. Or he would say, I had no idea. You know, I kept getting the Pantheon confused with the Parthenon.
Right.
Which I just think is a really, it helps you identify with them, and it pulls you along into, as opposed to someone who's like, who's giving you all the proper terms in Italian, and is letting you know, I've really mastered this thing. He has that appealing amateur, and when I say amateur, I think of it in the terms like the French word, which is a lover. Like he loves these things. It's not that he's expert in these things, but he approaches all of it with a kind of love. Mm. And I think that shines through.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, having read some of his other books, so this is the only one that I've read that I believe this is the only memoir he's written, but his other books of fiction, he has a real sympathy for the characters. And I think you feel for these characters. Like he does a really good job at making them well-rounded people. And I think you can, I hope that he's a well-rounded person too, but that in the memoir, the people they meet, I mean, he is sympathetic, you know, and I mean that I'm probably thinking of the Italian word simpatico. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's simpatico is, you know, it's gets translated as nice, but that doesn't quite, you know, how would you translate simpatico?
It's hard. I don't think there would be a, because I think it's somewhere between nice and sympathetic, because sympathetic is a little bit too.
It's also like understanding each other. Uh-huh.
Like when you say two people are in tune.
Yeah,
you
know, yeah.
Like we're in sync.
Yeah,
we're simpathici.
But he has that he actually I was later on in the book. They have an episode where his wife needs to go to the hospital, and it ends up just being a minor thing. She's dehydrated, and he tries, you know, with his broken Italian to explain to the doctor, because the doctor asked, could she be dehydrated? And she realizes she's only had one glass of water all day. And he says to the doctor, we have twins, you know, so like that's going to explain. And the doctor just, and he doesn't know. Does the doctor just think I'm an idiot, you know, or did I not make myself, am I talking about the grapefruit sauce when I meant tomato? Like, did I just say something wrong? And that's another thing as a, you know, non-native Italian speaker, having lived in Italy, there's so many things that resonated with me. You know, I've lived in Italy several different times in my life, and that different stages of language learning. So beginning with, like basically zero, just about zero. Maybe I knew ciao, buongiorno, you know, whatever. But, and that's kind of where they're coming in. And that's, you know, I remember people telling me, you'll pick it up so quickly. And it's a lie. It is a big lie.
Well, I think in one sense, you're picking up more than you realize quickly. Do you know what I mean? But you're not at a place where you've got what you consider proficiency.
No. And this is the interesting thing. I think being a parent of a small child is it renders you childlike. Mm-hmm. So what can be frustrating, even for me now, you know, and I consider myself, you know, pretty much fluent in Italian, but I am not as easy. I'm not at my ease in Italian as I am in English. And especially it depends on what we're talking about. So if we go off, you know, people start talking about architecture, I lack the vocabulary in Italian to really talk about it. But there's that frustration of feeling like there's something I want to say, but I don't know how to make the words. And
see, our architecture for me would be fine because I lack the vocabulary in English too.
No, but this idea of I lack the words, I was thinking, like, you know, when kids are little and you say use your words, and they're like, oh, I don't want to use my words, I want to bite someone, you know. So there's that when you don't have the words, it's so frustrating. And it's not just because, I mean, and it's true, yeah, but actually you make a good point, because I think that we forget that even in our, you know, native tongue, that we're not always able to express exactly what we're thinking or what we're feeling, for sure. But It also, of course, reminded me of the year that we spent when we had a, let's see, 2.5-year-old when we got there. Yeah, he turned 3 while we were there.
Yep.
So we spent a year in Florence, which I'll be honest, I've lived in Rome and I've lived in Florence. I think Florence is a more manageable city. Mm-hmm. It's much, much smaller. I love Rome for many, many reasons. And I love Florence for many reasons. I mean, different reasons probably. I don't think it's like one is better than the other. But I do think in some ways Florence might be an easier place for, especially for expats. Although there are plenty of expats in Rome for sure. Mm-hmm. It's just that it's bigger.
It's louder.
It's bigger. It's louder. It, you end up in Rome kind of the situation you have in New York City, and I'm sure also Paris, London, other large cities, where you end up, it's almost like this giant city composed of various little villages. Mm-hmm. And so you end up really in your little village. You get to know your greengrocer, your butcher.
Yeah, he's living in Trastevere, right? That's...
Yeah, which, you know, that's, you can't pick a nicer place to live in Rome for a year. But it's challenging to get around, and I can't imagine trying to get around with 2 6-month-olds, you know, public transportation. They don't have a car, and they don't want to really drive around the city anyway, and I wouldn't recommend it. But, you know, public transportation with 2 little kids. You know, we lived in Manhattan when we had our first 2 kids, and it's sort of like, you know, the pros and cons of living in a large city with small children. It, mm-hmm. it is in many ways really easy to get around. I was talking with someone recently and I said, you know, we came out of our building and within 15-minute walk, there were probably 4 playgrounds I could have taken the kids to. And it would be like, okay, do we want the one with the splash, you know, with the, whatever, the fountain? Do we want the one with the swings, with the kiddie swings? Do we want the one with the spinny round? Like, there were so many options, and you never had to get in a car. But on the other hand, you were doing a lot of walking, and you had to have kids in the stroller because you can't just, you know, let them loose running. You know, I did let them loose running down the sidewalk, but at a later age. So there's challenges to that as well. You know, I was thinking also, I was reminded of that year. So the year that we spent when our oldest was 2 to 3 years old. Jim was a stay-at-home dad, which was also a unique experience.
Yes, they called me the babbo sitter.
The babbo sitter. Babbo is Tuscan for daddy.
Yeah.
So other places in Italy, they say papa, but, you know, babbo is, you know, babbo sitter. But that's kind of the idea of that you're not a babysitter, you're his dad.
Right. So... But it was definitely a little bit unusual for people, for the old women to see the dad with kids.
So I think they thought you were a complete incompetent. You know, the old ladies at the playground.
That's because I was.
Well, like, all right. But the old, they would come over and, you know, do things like if Sam's shirt was untucked and his belly was exposed, which... You can get cold air on your belly and then you get a tummy ache and then you get diarrhea or something. You know, they would come over and tuck his shirt in for him, which he did not appreciate at all. Another thing I remember is that when we were in Italy, you know, we were there for almost a full year. And I know we both wanted to improve our Italian. So we said, hey, let's try to speak Italian at home. We're going to be speaking Italian at home. Right. And I remember him saying, you know, here we have like a 2.5-year-old who's kind of just catching on with language at all.
Yeah.
Back home. And then we transport him to a place where everyone's speaking Italian. And I remember him saying,
speak normal.
Just speak normal. And I think he just, you know, it was kind of like everyone is speaking Italian everywhere else. Couldn't we just speak normal at home? It was not the easiest year for making little kid friends, which kind of surprised me. That wasn't something I was expecting because there, at least where we were living in Florence, there were nursery schools all over the place.
Yeah. And it was state. But we probably should have just enrolled him in a nursery school.
We probably should have. I think at the time I thought he's 2.5.
Right.
New country, move, leaving all his everything familiar at home. I thought it would be too much. It would have been a lot. I don't know if it would have been too much.
But it also might have been more kids and more fun.
Yeah.
Too.
So
because we did, you know, I would take him to the Asilo Nido.
Oh, downtown?
Downtown occasionally.
Yeah. So,
but not as, you know.
You should say what the Ludoteca, I thought.
Oh, the Ludoteca. That's what I meant. Yeah.
So a Ludoteca is really a play space. And it was, there are a couple of these. You have to kind of search them out. And some towns have, you know, just it's sort of an open play space with toys and puzzles, and you see other kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, nearby we had a playground, but it tended to be pretty quiet until after lunch, you know, because the kids were in school. And then there, you know, I would say most of the families were dual income and, you know, both parents working. So if there was anyone at the playground watching the kids, it was the, you know,
And there was that one girl who was like, teenage girl from Romania, and I'm trying to remember her name.
I mean, that was 20 years ago.
But I do remember because she spoke English. She spoke Italian, English, and Romanian. And she was really great with Sam.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm trying to think some of the things that we, you know, what we experienced with traveling with a, and not just traveling, but living in a foreign country with a child. And I you know, again, as I said, what people said to me going to Italy without speaking Italian, oh, you'll pick it up. I remember people saying, oh, you know, kids are like sponges. They'll just pick it up. But that really varies. And it's not as easy as you might think. You know, there's also a lot of forget. It's sort of like how we forget how we learned how to speak. Huh? There's a lot of trial and error. There's a lot of frustration. You know, why do little kids cry all the time? You know, I think that some of it is that they just can't really express, and it's not just verbally. They have a whole lot of emotions and a whole lot of feelings and things going on, and they perhaps can't even express it to their own selves. You know, what's going on in their? Are they tired? Is it time for a nap? But it was a great year. You know, it's funny. Not that long ago, we got a real bad thunderstorm here. A sudden thunderstorm, we got hail. And I was reminded of how, I would say 3 or 4 times it hailed while we were in Florence. And I guess it's just something that happens more. And it was tiny hail, you know, like the size of, you know, kosher salt, kind of, you know, large grain salt. And I was struck by just, I remember looking out the window with Sam to look at the hail. And, you know, things like that, little details like that, that were different. I mean, we lived in a 400-year-old farmhouse that was right on the outskirts of Florence. So that was unusual, you know, when you think about it. That's not something that many people, you know, it was really, really cold in the winter. It was really, really hot in the summer. But all the challenges of being a new parent in some ways are magnified when you are then in a foreign country. You know, perhaps I should mention, we probably have mentioned in previous episodes that one of my day jobs is that I work as a doula. So I'm a childbirth assistant, and I also work as a postpartum doula. So I will assist new parents in that transition. And so I still feel like I kind of have at least a toe in this world. And I see that it's not any easier. Like, you know, it's just, it's a challenging transitional time. I think becoming a parent is a whole change of identity. You know, as a doula who works for childbirth, I have to say I know it's going to be easier when someone contacts me and it's their second or third birth. I just know it. Because that transition of going from 0 to 1 is so much more difficult than going from 1 to 2. And the change of identity of going from non-parent to parent is so much more dramatic than going from parent of 1 child to parent of 2, in my opinion. you know, obviously there are lots of exceptions to that, but I think he, in this book, he kind of captures that, you know, this the challenges and it's such a time of transition. And at the same time, as luck would have it, they have this huge, you know, and it's one of those opportunities. How can you say no to? I think it's like a really snowy day in Boise when they get the letter. And it's like, how can you say no?
It's very strange the way he's sort of thrown into it. As you said earlier, he doesn't even know what the Rome Prize is when he gets it. It's kind of like, you may have won. It's like Ed McMahon suddenly says, you've won. And his description of the other people, because they're like, it seems like everyone is either a Latinist or an Italianist or an Italianist and a Latinist who are fluent and know the area and know the history much better. And his writing is not going to have anything to do with Italy. Yeah. It's going to be about British and French in Normandy.
Right. But I think that's the thing. Some of that I think is his self deprecating.
Yes.
But the Rome Prize is not just for specialists of Rome.
Right.
It's also for artists who, just to give them the time and the space, and it just happens to be in Rome. You know, for some people, you know, perhaps who are writing a dissertation on a Roman topic, it makes tons of sense because you have access to all the archives, the libraries and the archives right there. But it's also, there are other, I mean, it's also the Fulbright is like this as well.
Yeah.
So the Fulbright is another, that's obviously-
That's what Anne had. Anne had
that's run through the State Department.
Did we mention that this podcast? I feel like there should be a drinking game for our podcast in a Fulbright. I don't think we've talked about the Fulbright very much.
I wasn't going to mention it.
Oh, Anne won a Fulbright in 2001.
That was 20 years ago. but there are various Fulbrights. I mean, that there are Fulbrights for, you know, in my case, I was doing research that was relevant to my dissertation. But some people have Fulbrights, you know, there are faculty Fulbrights for that typically are, you know, university professors, and it may be sort of tangential to their research interests. There are Fulbrights for teaching English abroad. There's the National Geographic Storyteller Fulbrights for kind of documenting these stories in various new media. Right. So writing it, but
also, whether you have a Fulbright or have won the Rome Prize, the one thing for me that the book really, that Anthony Doerr, I would hope people who read it take away, is that they should be encouraged to be an innocent abroad, because that's kind of the most important thing to do if you have a hankering to go, is to go. And just to be present and to be open to it.
Yeah, it's interesting because I saw, I think it was an article or maybe it was a slideshow or something, but it was like how not to look like a tourist when you're in Italy. And on the one hand, I get that. You know, I get that. I mean, in a very practical sense, you don't want to be a target for pickpockets or something. But, you know, I think in this book it describes, they're just so overwhelmed. Like not looking like they're from Idaho is the last, like... They're just trying to survive. Right. You know, they're just trying to eat. I think that first night when they
get there. I need to find out
there,
how to get the doctor because my kids and my wife are sick.
Right,
we're all
I need
sick.
To find. Or that first night they get there, I think this is really great, where they everything has closed. I think it's late at night because, of course, you're coming from Idaho. There are several changes. It was a very long flight and they have nothing but a couple of saltines that I think they took off. And, you know, that like. We're so, I mean, especially this is 15 years and a lot has changed also in Italy in 15 years. We're so used to, you know, just, I was going to say, pick up the phone and call. You don't even have to call. You just do DoorDash or something and someone will come and bring you some food. But that feeling of, I think you said it, vulnerability. And I think that when you live in a foreign country, and perhaps also not just a foreign country, but maybe just being away from your home turf. And also when you have a large life adjustment, such as becoming a parent, something like that, I think being vulnerable can be an asset. You know, I think it's an asset to his writing. I think for sure that there's a kind of, you know, I think it evokes a sort of sympathy in the reader. because he just seems so honest. I mean, this isn't like, you know, and then imagine Anthony Doerr, then he's got the sunglasses and he's riding on a Vespa. He's not. I mean, and he is going to go back to Boise, although I was reading it, you know, by the end, I'm like, how can you go? You know,
he's wearing cargo pants and a baseball cap. Come on.
I don't like winters. So it would be really, really hard for me to go to Idaho after.
Oh, there are microclimates, I've been told, in Idaho that are actually quite mild.
Well, then we're going to have to check it out, and yeah, we'll be the fish out of water.
That's right. I've heard very good things about Idaho.
Okay. Well, yes, if you live in Idaho, please drop us a line and tell us how it compares with Italy. But I highly recommend it. I think this was my second time reading the book. Four Seasons in Rome by Anthony Doerr, Doerr.
Also author of Cloud Cuckoo Land.
His most recent book was Cloud Cuckoo Land. And he also wrote The Shell Collector, About Grace, and All the Light We Cannot See, and one or two other books that I'm probably forgetting. And it is, I would actually recommend it before you go to Rome. Like, if you're going to visit Rome, I think it's worth reading. It's not like it's a guidebook.
Right. I was about to say, I read it long after I'd been to Rome many times, and I still liked it. So yeah, you could do it anytime. But definitely, if you haven't gone, I think it's an encouraging thing, because you kind of go, yeah, you just kind of, you let yourself be flung.
Yeah. And I think if you are a traveler, and I also think it would appeal to parents. You know, it sort of is a parent memoir in its own way. You know, it's definitely a living abroad memoir. But I think it's also, you know, to me, it actually brought up a whole, like what we were just talking about, brought up a whole lot of memories of 20 years ago. It's hard to believe it's been 20 years, you know, and how those early years seem like they go on forever.
Mm-hmm.
But just like everyone tells you, like everyone tells you when your kids are little, they're like, it goes by so fast. And it really does. But that doesn't help when your kid is teething and is screaming their heads off. Because when you're in the moment, it feels like it's going on forever. That's for sure.
Great.
Yeah. All right. So Anthony Doerr, Four Seasons in Rome. We should probably reach out to him.
Thank you, man. Thank you for another wonderful podcast.
Thank you, too. Oh, another thing I did to prepare for this episode, you can see how highly prepared I was, is I grabbed an old photo album. Maybe I should post some of the old photos.
I think, that seems kind of just...
Yeah, it's weird.
No, it's not weird, Dice,
Self-indulgent.
I was going to say posting photos of little kids, but they're all like 22 years old now. So it's kind of like, you know.
Yeah, I wasn't going to post. Who wants to see kids? No, I was looking at the pictures. So I was like, wow, I look pretty good 20 years ago.
Yeah, I look like crap.
Stay at home dad.
All right. Alla prossima.
Ciao, ciao.